Today is Monday, March 5th, 2018, and we are here at United Orthodox Synagogues for our second class on archaeology and the Torah, how we use archaeology to understand the Torah better. Today we have one, maybe two topics. We'll see how far we get into, how long it takes us to do the first topic. And so everyone should have a source book in front of you. I'll have other things to show you along the way as we go. And this is related to the topics of the Torah that we are involved in now. We're now involved in the section of the Torah that deals with the building of the Mishkan. And the building of the Mishkan took a lot of artisanship, a lot of craftsmanship on the part of the Jewish people. They had to know... how to work with precious metals. They had to know how to work with precious stones and how to cut them and how to get them to size. They had to know how to weave specific types of covers for the Mishkan. So there was a lot of very, very high level, carpentry and artisanship that needed to be used in order to properly build the Mishkan. And so one of the very interesting questions that the commentaries ask is, where did the Jewish people learn all of these very high-level skills and these very sort of fine type of skills, and which they had to start doing almost immediately when they came out of Egypt?
Have another question. Where do they get the tools besides the skills? They take them all with
That's a good
Egypt?
Question. I think the answer that we're going to suggest tonight may also apply to where they got the tools. Yeah.
I also think that not every slave was out making stones. There were some artisans. There were some other things that had to be done for the.
We have no record of that. All we have is that they were making stones. So that's all we have to go on.
Somebody had to do the other work.
Maybe. Well, I don't know. I don't know if that's true. We don't know. Yeah, it could have been Egyptians.
Wouldn't this be the same question you would ask as we would look in a sixth grade book on cultures? In China, they were doing things, and in Africa, they were doing. So it would be the same question to be asked of any beginning peoples.
Beginning peoples are often using things which are very simple
right. And
very crass, and then they get to it eventually.
Right.
But there was no time to get to it eventually. They're in Egypt for hundreds of years.
Okay.
There's no indication that they were involved in this type of stuff. And all of a sudden, within a few months of leaving Egypt,
okay. They're
building this beautiful temple with stones and gold and bronze and... That's the question. You're right. They didn't have the normal build-up period to go from, killing animals by throwing boulders at them to then figuring out how to make a spear. They didn't have that. That seemed they didn't have that time.
Did they
perhaps
watch the Egyptians?
Could be.
Their contact with Sumerian culture.
Right.
They could have picked up some skills.
Good. Okay. So let's see, because there's some very interesting material. Today's discussion is based on this wonderful book called Parashat Derachim, which is a book that goes parsha by parsha, weekly portion by weekly portion, which the subtitle is a Mabat Archeologi V'Geografi B'Parshiot HaShavua. So a study or a view, an archaeological and geographical view of the weekly portion. It's written by Yitzchak Meitlis, and this is very interesting. I picked up this book a few years ago in Israel. I brought it home, and I showed Gabi. I said, Gabi, look, I found this amazing book. And she says, oh, yeah, he's my cousin. He's Gabi's cousin. And the book is actually dedicated to his mother, Sonia Meitlis, who I met. When I was visiting with Gabi and some other family members, and he is a world-renowned archaeologist, and he's religious, and so he took it upon himself to write this book to help understand the Torah better using what he has learned as an archaeologist. So it's an amazing book. He actually reached out to me. I sent him a recording of another class I did based on the book. He reached out to me to see if I could help him get it translated. I think he's trying to get it translated into English. It would be a really wonderful service. Anyway, so he's dealing with this question, right? Where did they get this expertise? He starts out by saying in the Parsha of Vayakel Pekudei, which we're going to read this Shabbos, I think, there is a great deal of detail of the type of artisanship that is necessary to build the Mishkan. And he asked the question, Heichan rachashu amanim eila et hayeda ketzad lavod b'zahav b'kesef uv'nechoshet. Where did these artists get the knowledge of how to work with gold, silver, and bronze? And then he puts the question very specifically, Hare Am Yisrael haya am shel avadim she'asak b'binia v'libun levenim. The Jewish people were a group who worked with building and forming bricks, like a more coarse type of work. HaTorah, right? So then where do they get this other expertise from? And then he says the Torah itself specifically notes, if you look at source number 2, the Torah itself specifically notes, Milei otam chachmat lev lasot kol melechet charash v'choshev v'rokeim patechelet uva'argaman b'tolat hashani uva'shesh v'oreg osei kol melecha v'choshve machashavot. These artisans, the Torah says, right, have been endowed with the skill to do any work of the carver, the designer, the embroider in blue, purple, crimson yarns, and in fine linen, and of the weaver, as workers in all craft, and as makers of design. So the Torah, what's the Torah's answer to our question? Where did they learn all of this artisanry from?
They were endowed by God.
By their creator.
God, right, God helped them. Meaning, they didn't know how to do it. Of course they didn't know how to do it. For hundreds of years, they're building... I'm always impressed when I see people building houses. It's amazing to me that people have the skill, but they don't necessarily have the skill of how to make jewelry. And a jeweler does not know how to build a house, right? These are specific skills, right? So where did they get it from? They didn't. All of a sudden, they left Egypt, and it sounds like one morning a guy woke up and says, "Wow, I know how to do this now." Right? God gave them, he just poof, magic.
What's interesting is this, here, all the things that they're talking about, I guess the carver, but the other things are all weaving and sewing and whatever, that they possibly knew how to do, but not with this fine whatever. I mean, someone had to make even the clothes
could be, yeah, right? But not with this specific type of materials they're using,
right.
And the bronze and the metal, the metalwork also remains, right, a mystery. Okay, and in fact, and by the way, these are the psukim in source number 1. Ve'asa b'tzalel v'aliyah v'chol ish chacham lev asher natan Hashem chachma utvuna. Right, God endowed them with the skill and ability to perform expertly all the tasks connected with the service of the sanctuary, to carry out all the Lord that has commanded. And source number 3, Re'e Karati B'Shem B'Tzal Ben Uri Ben Chor L'Mate Yudah. This constant theme that this was a miracle. That's what it was. It was a miracle that they didn't know how to do it, and all of a sudden they know how to do it. Okay, that's a perfectly plausible answer. Okay, and in fact, if you, the Ramban says this, if you turn to page 2, the Ramban asks the question. Page 2, you see source number 4. See, I have proclaimed by the name Bezalel, son of Uri, son of Hur. God said to Moses here, when he informed him of Bezalel's appointment to oversee the construction of the temple, see, I have proclaimed by name Bezalel. And similarly, Moshe said to Israel when he informed them of Bezalel's appointment, see, Hashem has proclaimed by name Bezalel. And the reason for this calling of attention to Bezalel's selection is, right, meaning what God has to tell Moshe that's Bezalel. Bezalel has to tell the Jewish people. Moshe has to tell the Jewish people it's Bezalel. Just do it. Why do we need all this attention paid to the person? And so the Ramban says, and the reason for this calling of attention to Bezalel's selection is that the Israelites of Egypt, crushed as they were by backbreaking physical labor of mortar and bricks, did not have the opportunity to learn the highly skilled crafts of working with silver, gold, and cutting precious stones. Nor had they even seen such crafts performed by others at all. Right? Maybe what he's saying is, if in fact this was what was done in Egypt, maybe it was done in Egypt in their temples. And the Egyptians didn't want these foreigners in their temples. That was going to be set aside for the Egyptian craftsmen. The slave laborers were going to build other things, what he calls the backbreaking physical labor of mortar and bricks. It was thus a wonder that there should be found among them a man who was such a great artisan in working with silver and gold and with cutting pieces, precious stones, and carving wood, and who was a weaver of designs and an embroiderer and a weaver. For even among those who study these crafts under artisans, there cannot be found one person who was an expert in every one of the aforementioned crafts. Right? Bezalel could do everything. He was
some jack of all trades.
Yeah, right? And even those, and the Rambam goes even further, and even those who do know and are accustomed to one of those crafts, if subsequently their hands should come constantly into involvement with clay and mud, they find that they are not able to perform the same fine and beautiful work they once did. Right? You're out of practice. This is the type of thing that requires you to be deft, and you have to do it on a regular basis. So even if somehow some of the Jews who came into Egypt were knowledgeable of this, over the course of hundreds of years, the art was lost.
So who built the golden calf then? How did they do that?
That was my next question.
Ah, we'll see. Maybe that's the same answer.
I read some, I think it was that Bezalel was 13 years old when I think there was a mention of his age, that he was very, very young, as young as 13.
Right, which begs the question even more. Right. Right. He was born into slavery. He never knew anything other than bricks and mortar. Where did he learn this from? So the Torah's answer, it was a miracle.
Lightning.
God did it. That's a perfectly wonderful answer. However, my long-lost cousin, Yitzhak Maitlis, he suggests another answer. And he says as follows. I'll read you a little bit of what he says, and then we'll look at some of the sources. He says, Ulam ha'im haya zeh ma'senes bilvad, o shema haya gam basis tiv'i l'melechet umanutam. Are we forced to say that it was entirely a miraculous occurrence, that the Jews knew how to do this, or is there some natural explanation that could be given for this? So along the lines of what was said earlier, he says, if we look around that period of time and in that neighborhood, which people were able, la'asok ba'omanut ha'zahav ha'kesef ha'nechoshet, who were able, who were experts in working with precious metals, nimtza ki ha'mu'umadim ha'tivim biyoter heim ha'kenim, kinim, a nation of people, the Kenites, K-E-N-I-T-E. Hakinim hayu mukarim ba'olam hakadum kicharshe matechet. This tribe, they were well known in the ancient world for being experts of working with metal. The etzem hamilim kin a v'kin e mitparshot ba'aramit ubesurit kicharash matechet. The very word Keni is translated in Aramaic as someone who, an artisan who works with metal. That's what the word means, right? That so this nation's name means someone who works with metal. Al Kain, and therefore he says, for example, he calls our attention to a verse in Judges, in Shoftim, chapter 17, verse 4, that says the follows. Vayashev et hakesef li'imo, vatikach imo matayim kesef, v'titznenu litzoref, Vayaseu pesel umasecha vayhi bevet Michayahu. So when he gave the silver back to his mother took 200 shekels of silver and gave it to the smith. Right? This is the smith is the one who knows how to make these things. He made of it sculptured image and a molten image, which were kept in the house of Micha. So Yitzhak Maitlis says, look at the Targum Yonatan, which is an Aramaic translation of the Bible. And he says, Ve'etev yat kaspa le'ime, so when he gave the silver back to his mother, Unisivat ime matan sala'in diksaf, his mother took 200 shekels of silver, V'yahavte, and she gave it to who? Likina'a. Likina'a, which is the smith. The Aramaic word for a metal smith is Kina'a, which is this nation's name, right? So he says, he's building his case that this nation were potentially the ones in that neighborhood who knew how to do these things. So he says, so he says his first point is, we have a biblical record. We have a linguistic hint that this nation is possibly a nation that was well known as metalsmiths. Okay? Then he says, however, it's not only the linguistic record. He says, Gam, he also says the archaeological record, Milamed ki hamidainim, the Midyanim, right? Shakenim hayu chelek mehem. The Kenim were sort of a sub-tribe of the Midyanim, right? Hitamchu b'hakafat nechoshet. They were also involved in bronze work. And then he turns our attention to some archaeological digs that were done in the Timna Valley. Okay? The Timna Valley is located in southern Israel, in the southwestern Arava, 19 miles north of the Gulf of Aqaba and the city of Eilat. So it's a little north of Eilat. The area, listen to this, is rich in copper ore and has been mined since the 5th millennium BCE. There is controversy. Okay, a large section of the valley containing ancient remnants of copper mining and ancient worship is encompassed in a recreation park. Copper has been mined in the area since the 6th or 5th millennium BCE. Now, this story is earlier than that, but he's willing to suggest that maybe the existence of it there could also hint that maybe it existed before what we actually know. Archaeological excavation indicates that the copper mines in the Timna Valley were probably part of the kingdom of Edom and worked by the Edomites, described as biblical foes of the Israelites during the 10th century BCE, the period of King Solomon. Mining continued by the Israelites and Nabataeans through the first and second centuries. If you read about the Canaanites, according to the Hebrew Bible, the Canaanites were a nomadic clan in the ancient Levant. One of the most recognized Canaanites is Yitro. Oh. That makes perfect sense. Yitro shows up right after the Jews left Egypt. He says, I heard what's going on. And maybe he
brought people with him.
Or he brought the expertise with him, right? They played an important role in the history of ancient Israel. The Canaanites were coppersmiths and metal workers. Moshe's father-in-law Yitro was a shepherd and a priest in the land of Midian, etc. So he puts all this together and says, maybe this is what you said. Maybe, and it wasn't a chance happening. It wasn't a chance happening with some nomadic tribe. It was Moshe's own father-in-law was a high priest of people who were experts in this, right? And I'll read you what Maitlis says. He says, first of all, in archaeological digs in the Timna Valley, he says, Hitgala mirkaz nerchav shel kiryat nechoshet uvo klicheres rabim haofyanim limadainim. He says, we've also found, I think this is his main point, they've also found all sorts of vessels which go back to that time. So he's suggesting it goes back earlier. V'chein mikdash midyani shaya mechuseh biyiriot bad. He also says, I found this too. They also found a temple. They found a Canaanite temple that was also covered by all sorts of woven material. So now we have an answer to maybe two of our questions. Where did they learn how to do the metalwork? And where did they learn how to do all the fancy weaving? From these people. I'll read you about this shrine. It's called the Shrine of Hathor. Benno Rothenberg, the main excavator of the Timna Valley area, excavated a small Egyptian temple dedicated to Hathor, the Egyptian goddess of mining, and the base of Solomon's pillars. It was built during the reign of Pharaoh Seti I at the end of the 14th century BCE. Now we're getting into the same neighborhood of time. The shrine housed an open courtyard with a cella. Anyway, he goes on and on to say that eventually this shrine was taken over by the Midianim. Hmm. The Egyptians were banished, and another group came in and took it over. When the Egyptians left the area in the middle of the 12th century, the Midianites continued using the temple. They erased the evidence of the Egyptian cult, effaced the images of Hathor and the Egyptian hieroglyphics, and built a bench offering on the side. They turned the temple into a tented desert shrine. So tented with woven things, right? So Maitlis is building his case. He says, so we also have this temple. And then he says as follows, Ki yadua Yitro Chotein Moshe Hayashayach L'Kvutzat Anashim HaMechunim Kenim. Yitro, Moshe's father-in-law, we know him as a Midianite, but if you look at another verse, he is called specifically someone who is a Kenai. Look at source number 8. Uvene Kenai Chotein Moshe, the descendants of the Kenite, the father-in-law of Moshe. We always call Yitro a Midianite, but we know that the Kenim were sort of a... Yeah, you could be a Texan, and then you're a Houstonian, right? So you could be a Kenai, and you could be a Midianite, but you could be a Kenai too, right? Chotein Moshe, Alu Meir HaTmarim, Et Bnei Yehuda, etc., etc. So he says it's not impossible to suggest that Yitro, Taram LeMoshe, gave to Moshe, Lo Rak Eitzah Hashuvah Ketzad Liyael Et Marechet HaMishpat. We know that when Yitro showed up, what's the first thing he says to Moshe?
How to set up the...
Right. You're going to burn out. You're answering everyone's questions. You're working too hard. You need to set up some sort of court system where maybe not so difficult or not such important questions, but the important questions will come to you. So we know that Yitro was happy to share advice and guidance with Moshe. So he says it's not impossible to suggest that it's not only this type of advice that Yitro gave to him, Ela af yeda b'tchum umanut hamatechet. He also gave him advice on how to, or training, mm-hmm. right, on how to do metalwork. And then Maitlis turns our attention to an archaeologist, Nelson Gluck, who I did not hear about before I started doing this work. Nelson Gluck is a fascinating fellow. He lived from 1900 to 1971. He was born in Cincinnati, Ohio, and he was a leader in the field of biblical archaeology. If the name sounds familiar to you, he gave the benediction at the swearing-in ceremony for John F. Kennedy. Okay,
what's so his last name again?
Gluck, G-L-U-E-C-K. At the age of 23, what's that? It's pronounced Glick?
I know it's on Charlie. I think it's pronounced. Charlie pronounced it Glick.
Okay, thank you. At the age of 23, Glick was ordained as a Reform rabbi by the Hebrew Union College, and 4 years later was awarded his PhD in Germany for his dissertation on the biblical concept of chesed. Until World War II, he worked with William Foxwell Albright at the American School of Oriental Research in Jerusalem, and at Albright's excavation of Tel Beit Mirsin. Later, Glick himself served as director. Okay. He was a prolific scholar, excavator, and surveyor. His early work centered on the exploration of Transjordan, where he identified over 1,000 ancient sites, and the Negev, where he found over another 500. So he is very accomplished. He found a lot of stuff. And this, so he He, by the way, after he eventually became the president of Hebrew Union College, and it says here that, that he believed that the Hebrew Bible contains historical memory, but one that cannot be proven. But he's the one who's done a lot of this work, and he wrote in a book, which I think was translated to be Rivers in the Desert, An Adventure in Archaeology, which is published in 1959. He writes in follows. He says, it's almost without a doubt that the Canaanim provided the Jewish people the secrets of metalwork. Right? He's convinced, based on the verses, based on the temple, based on the presence of the, what did we say earlier, of all those copper mines that were found and tools that were found, he's convinced that the Canaanim gave it to the Jewish people. Umi pihem lamad Moshe lasot nachash nechoshet. Right, there's a story where Moshe makes a snake out of bronze. Where did Moshe know how to make a snake out of bronze? He says it. Oh, he's convinced that it came from them. Yeterah mizot, keini haya hayotzer harishon shel kli nechoshet ubarzel. He says the first the keini were the first to first to do this. And that's in his book, which I think is, I'm not sure, but I think it's his book called Rivers in the Desert, An Adventure in Archaeology. So that is a really amazing approach to this, right? Where the Torah poses a very difficult problem, right? Just to sort of review. All of a sudden, the Jews come out of Egypt, and they are building a fancy temple with high-level artisanry, which requires very fine skills, and there's no indication anywhere in the Torah of where they knew how to do it from. Okay? So comes along the Ramban, Nachmanides, and he gives a wonderful answer, which is, oh, God endowed the person, Bezalel, and maybe then Bezalel trained other people, and that's how it happened. Yitzhak Meitler says, yeah, that's possible, but here's another possibility. Right? If you want to understand sort of a more natural way of where it came from this tribe, which had direct and open ties with the Jewish people, right, with Am Yisrael through Yitro, and they're well known and the first people to develop the skill, and it's quite possible, Meitler says, and Gluck is convinced without a doubt that is, again, because Gluck is not so fast to accept a supernatural explanation of this. And so he's convinced without a doubt that it came from this group of people. This could also answer the question of how they knew how to make the golden calf, right? If you're looking to figure that out. And it could answer all sorts of other questions, where they got the tools from, they learned how to make them or got them from their local Caney Home Depot, right? Or Lowe's, or whatever the equivalent was back then, right? It answers a lot of questions. It also answers the questions of where they got the material from, right? Some of the material could have come from Egypt. They brought out with them. We know that they came out of Egypt with a lot of things. But it also opens up the possibility that they were engaged in trading with this group and maybe with other groups that they met along the way. So this is a great example of how knowledge of archaeology and history can help us understand verses in the Torah a little clearer. Okay, and this is also important, I think, because supernatural answers don't satisfy everybody. Right? It satisfies some people, but it doesn't satisfy everyone. And this is an opportunity to be able to sort of lend validity to the Torah's account of what happened, and then you'd have to go back and look at the verses. What do the verses mean, though, when it says that God endowed Bezalel with ability? Well, then you could say, yeah, he was the one who was most adept, meaning once these people came and were training the Jewish people, Bezalel was the one who had this, you know, God-given, right? Not everyone, I could probably be taught, someone could say to me and show me how to do these things. I won't necessarily know, I won't be good at it. I remember when I was in Yeshiva University, we were able to take a class on shechting, on slaughtering chickens. And the first thing you have to do is you have to learn how to sharpen the knife. I couldn't get it. They gave you a knife, and they gave you a sharpening stone, and they showed you how to do it. And if you didn't do it exactly the right amount on both sides, it was dull. It ended up being dull on one side because you had to sharpen. But I couldn't even get near a chicken because I couldn't figure out. I just didn't have that feel.
Did you fail?
I guess I failed at Shechita. Yeah. That's why I'm a vegetarian.
You made an F.
So, well, you know, it was an elective. It was an elective. If you're listening, it was an elective. So, I just couldn't do it. So not everyone could do it. So, but Bezalel could, and that's what it means. And when God endowed Bezalel with the ability to do it, he gave him that was his special ability. So I think that's a beautiful way to learn how this happened in these what's going on in this section. Okay.
Just one question. Wouldn't most people, whether they like the idea of God given or not, if you have specific, as you're giving us the second half, specific evidence? I mean, doesn't the scale lean more that way?
The evidence may not be 100% because the dates don't necessarily match up. Michaelis is making a little bit of a jump in terms of how far back we have evidence that this group was in that area.
An assumption.
So I think that may be an approach. And again, people don't, there is a certain way of thinking that you don't want to let this type of evidence form the way you think about it, because then you run the risk of letting evidence that may disprove, or right. So that's what we talked about last week, where the absence of evidence for some people is enough to create doubt, and whether that's valid or not is what we discussed last week. Okay. One other thing he notes, just very quickly, he also notes the following.
Who are we talking about?
Maitlis notes that there was another connection, another specific connection between the Canim and Chur, who was from Shevet Yehuda. And Chur, who was from Shevet Yehuda, is the father of Bezalel, who built the Mishkan, right? So we're going to see some verses that show a connection between the Kenim and Chur from Shevet Yehuda, and Chur is the father of Bezalel. So he says, look at a verse in source number 10 on page number 3. It says, the families of the scribes that dwelt at Yavetz. And then he lists all the tribes, and it says, these are the Kenites who came from Hamat, father of the house of Rechav. Okay? So Maitlis says, at the end of a list of the Shevet Yehuda, of the tribe of Judah, there's this verse, which comes from Divrei HaYamim, right? Chronicles 1, chapter 2, verse 55. And Rashi understands, translates the word Kenim as Tsorfim, right? You know, there's an Israeli silver company called Hatsorfim, right? They're the ones who make, that's where it comes from, right? They're silversmiths, right? Haparshanim, he says, the commentaries are stuck on this word Yabetz, which is at the end of the first line. Whether it's a place or a person. The translation that I found has it as a place. However, some say it's a person. And if it's a person, right, and this person is mentioned in connection to the tribe of Judah, then look at another verse that says, I don't know if I brought this verse to you, another verse that says Vayhi Yabetz. That is a person. So he said this person Yabetz, according to the rabbis, was a nickname for Atniel ben Kenaz, who was the half-brother of Kalev ben Yefune. Well, I'm going to make sense of this in a minute. It says, if that's the case, l'divrei ha-pasuk b'divrei ha-yamim, according to our verse that we just read in Chronicles, chibro ha-kenim l'mishpachto shel Atniel ben Kenaz, the Kenim, who are mentioned in this verse, are connected to the family of Atniel ben Kenaz, who's the half-brother of Kalev ben Yefune, who was the father of Chor, and the grandfather of Bezalel, who built the Mishkan. So he's trying again, he's just building through these verses a family connection between the Kenim, these people who knew how to do this, and Bezalel, who was the one we read about, who is the actual builder of the Mishkan. And he points our attention to source number 11. Kalev, son of Chetzron, had children by his wife Azuvah and by Yeriot. These were her sons, Yesher, Veshovav, Veardon. And when Azuvah died, Kalev married Ephrat, who bore him Chur. Chur begot Uri, and Uri begot Bezalel. Right? Where does that come from? Atniel ben Kenaz is the half-brother of Kalev, who's the father of Chur. And Chur begot Uri, who begot Bezalel. So the direct connection is to the grandfather of Bezalel. And so that's how, that's another sort of piece of the puzzle that Maitlis puts together to try to prove a connection between the Jewish people at that time, maybe through Yitro and Moshe, or maybe directly through Bezalel, right, and his family lineage, to the people who knew how to build these things back in the day. Okay?
Who was Jeroth?
These are, he's just one of the children, but he's not part of this. It's not Yitro. This is someone else.
The way he's writing here, he call it must have had two wives.
Yeah, right, yeah. Yeah, Azuvah and Yeriot. Yeah, that was
these
common.
These were her sons.
That was common.
So whose sons were they? They were her sons.
Yeah, probably the last one, Yeriot.
Right, that's
yeah.
What I would think.
Yeah, okay. So that's it in terms of the question of where did Bnei Yisrael learn the skill that was mentioned. Okay, I want to now, just since we have a few minutes left, I want to turn to another interesting question. I dealt with part of this question on Shabbat, where we have a verse in the Torah that says you're not allowed, and this is not in the source sheets, you have a verse in the Torah that says you're not allowed to bring any karbanot, you're not allowed to bring any offerings that have chametz or honey in them, right? I don't know if people know this, that the all of the sort of meal offerings that were in the temple, in the Beit HaMikdash, were chametz free all year round. And they were also free of any honey, right? Mm-hmm. However, there's an obligation that all of the karbanot have salt. So last Shabbat, we talked about why chametz, as we're getting ready for Pesach, we talked about why chametz is bad in terms of why is it not allowed in the Beit HaMikdash, and did that help us understand why it's banned on Pesach? But we did not talk about is why all of the offerings must have salt. Right? What's the deal with that? So I want to spend a few minutes on that, because Yitzhak Maitlis has a fascinating chapter on that as well.
Do
so,
you mean the honey is not kosher?
No, it's kosher. You're just not allowed to have it in a karban. Of course it's kosher. Now, just can't have it in the temple in a sacrifice.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll start off with the Ramban, Nachmanides again. Well, first of all, we'll just say this, that the Rambam, Maimonides, says the reason why we have to have salt is because the pagan nations at that time did not have salt. So we want to show that our sacrifices are different than the pagans, right? Because when you start doing sacrifices, you run the risk of the following. How are we different than the pagans? They have temples, we have temples, they have animal sacrifices, we have animal sacrifices. How are we different? One way we're different is they had honey and they had leaven, so we don't have honey and we don't have leaven, and they didn't have salt, and so we do have salt. Okay? That is Maimonides, the Rambam's answer to the question. Okay? The Ramban answers differently. He says a very, very interesting answer. He says as follows, v'efshar, it's possible, v'itakein, b'pnei she'eno derech kavod liyot lechem, lechem Hashem tafel mibli melech. It's just not proper to give God a bland offering without salt. So this may, you know, rub you the wrong way as being very pagan. Right? What does God care? Why do we care? We don't believe that God's eating it. It's not like we believe that God's eating it, but it's just not right. Let me read you.
It's just that we're trying harder to do it.
Right. But it is also plausible that the reason for adding salt is because it would be not dignified for the bread of God to be insipid, okay, without salt. Okay? So that's one approach that's given in the Ramban. And there are some other approaches as well. A later authority, Shmuel David Lutzato, notes something else. He says, "Ad hayom hazeh nisi'ei ha'aravim shekortim brit mevi'im kli shel melech ve'ochlim yachad pat b'melech." Says to this day, and he's writing in the 20th century, right? To this day, kings and rulers who make a treaty, they always bring salt and they eat bread with salt. Right, that's the way an agreement was made, and a karban is sort of interaction, some sort of agreement between you and God. And so again, this is another example of holding on to some type of ancient, pre-existing structure and transferring it into Judaism. V'nei zehaya min hag yadu v'mei kedem ba'artzot ha-mizrach shabrit nikrat b'melech. It was well known in the ancient Near East that a covenant, an agreement, was made with salt. So that's the Ramban, says it's just not nice to bring something bland. And you have the Rambam, who says we do it because the Goyim didn't do it, the Gentiles didn't do it. And you have Shaddal, who says we're just, maybe similar to the Ramban, that we're mimicking ancient practices in terms of how we interact with God. Okay? However, says Maitlis, Rashi mentions an Agadah, a strange explanation of this, and he says, Shabrit kruta lemelech misheshet yemei bereshit. Shuftechu hamayim atachtonim likare b'mizbeach lemelech v'nisuch hamayim b'chag. A promise was made to the salt waters that they would play a role in the temple. How do they play a role in the temple? Salt always goes on the sacrifices, and on Sukkot there's a water pouring ritual. Okay? Now, so Maitlis says, why does Rashi accept this strange midrashic interpretation of this, instead of going with the more rational, seems to us reasonable, explanations of we're mimicking an ancient practice, it's not right to bring God something. If you're going to bring God something, you got to bring him your best. So it needs to, even though God's not going to eat it, it has to be at least conceptually the best, right? Why would Rashi do this? So he says, it's possible that Rashi wants to hit at something else. Says Rashi, he says salt, right, has a specific characteristic. It's a preservative, right? And it has the ability to make something last for a long time. And he says, so salt represents something that lasts forever, right? And so therefore we want to have salt on our karbanot to represent that the relationship between God and the Jewish people is forever. Okay? Just like salt preserves things, salt symbolizes the preservation of the bond between the Jewish people and God. And then Maitlis goes into this very interesting essay, a few paragraphs I'll share with you, about the importance of salt in that time. And he's suggesting that not only does salt have a symbolic importance, it was really important. And since it was really important, of course that's what you bring on your karban. Right? You bring the most important thing. Right? And so first of all, salt is important because, first of all, it back then it was the only preservative. Right? So it was very important in its own right. And then he notes this. This is fascinating. I looked this up today. He says, Nosaf al kach, haya mekubal letapel betinok shenolad bezrat ha-melech, melech, kefi shemishtama midirei ha-navi Yechezkel. He quotes a verse in Yechezkel. He says it was customary when babies were born, they were treated with salt. It would toughen up their skin. It was a health benefit to salt. And Rashi on the verse in Yechezkel says, "Mikan shemolchin et havlad kidei sheyitkasheh b'saro." They would rub the baby with salt in order to strengthen their skin. And a contemporary commentary called the Dat Mikra says that is still customary in nomadic tribes. When a baby is born, they treat the baby with salt. Additionally, and this I looked up today, salt is still used to separate impurities from metal. Talk about metal that we were talking about in the previous discussion, especially in aluminum. There's salt on the smelting in the smelting pot, and that allows the aluminum to become purified. So salt was a preservative. Salt had health benefits. Salt purified metals, right? And he says this: Chashivut haMelech hovila lehitpatchut taasiya sheaska biyitziro uvshivuko b'sefer Yoshua af nizkar makom b'shem ir haMelech. He says there is a city that's called the City of Salt, sheshachen lechofo sheyam haMelech, which was on Yam haMelech. And then he notes the following. You've probably all seen part of this, but not all of this. He reminds us of the Madaba map. Now, the Madaba map that most of us have seen is this. This Madaba map, a replica of it, is in the Cardo in Jerusalem. If you've ever been in the Cardo in Jerusalem, if you're walking through, there's this non-distinct ceramic map on the wall. Okay, this map was found in Madaba, Jordan. It's a map of the entire Middle East. The only part that's been reproduced in Jerusalem is the Jerusalem part of the map. And however, he says, if you look at the Madaba map, and I blew it up, there are, in this part of the map, which represents the Dead Sea, these two big ships piled high with a white powder, which he's suggesting is not cocaine, right? It's salt. They used to mean they would mine salt in the Dead Sea, and then they would ship it out to maybe also to Jerusalem, because that's where they needed the salt for all the karbanot. So he, again, he's an archaeologist. He looks at this map, and he's wondering, what on earth is this white stuff in these ships that's going towards Jerusalem? Since it's coming from the Dead Sea, it's likely salt.
Robert,
okay.
Just a quick note: you said salt to toughen up the baby's body.
Yeah.
This day, boxers rub brine, which is salt and water, on their face.
Really?
To toughen their skin up,
so they don't get cut.
Exactly.
Wow.
Right.
Interesting. All right. And then finally, he notes this very fascinating thing. He says, "Ma'ayin litzayin ki b'tkufat shilton ha'yivanim be'eretz Yisrael." He says, in the time of the Greek rule in Israel, hutal mas shinati al kol adam b'shem mas haMelech. There was a salt tax on every person. You had to pay it to the government in salt. They used to pay Roman legions in salt.
Therefore, the salary,
because that's what they were paid in. Al chashivuto shel hamelach nitan lilmod gam meachat meigrot bar kochva. He says even bar kochva, we have a letter. Again, this is why this knowledge is so important. We have a letter from bar kochva from the Judean desert, where he wants to make sure that his soldiers have enough salt.
Salt also
retains
moisture.
He wanted to make sure that his soldiers had enough salt for that, or for preserving whatever food they would have. And he also notes, "B'mikdash hayta lishkat hamelech." There was a storeroom which was called the storeroom of salt in the Beit HaMikdash, and this was where it was collected, maybe from the ships, and it was kept there to put salt on the karbanot. So he's suggesting all this evidence would also lead us to understanding another reason why salt is on all the karbanot, because it was gold. It was the most, one of the most important commodities of the time. And if you're going to bring a karban to God, right, in Eretz Yisrael, devash, right, date honey, that's a dime a dozen. There's date trees all over the place, right? And leaven, that's easy. You just let the water and the flour sit, it becomes leaven. But salt, that's hard to come by, obviously. So if you want to really show God that you're devoted, you put the most valuable thing on the karban. Now for us, when we read this, salt is like the cheapest commodity we have, right? We would never think about this. But if you go back and you look at how it was thought about in the ancient Near East, you have perhaps another layer of understanding of why we are not allowed to bring devash. We're not allowed to bring honey and leaven, because that's degrading. That's like bringing salt today. Right? That's degrading. But you have to bring salt, not necessarily because of what the Rambam says, because the Gentiles didn't, so we do, but because we want to bring
Something worthwhile.
So which just begs the question, what's going to happen when the Beit HaMikdash is rebuilt and salt is still dirt cheap? Right? Are we going to still bring salt, or are we going to, you know, redefine salt as, you know, gold dust or something else? All right, so these are two really neat examples of, you know, why it's helpful to understand archaeology in terms of if we want to understand the Torah a little bit better.
I read this book many years ago called Salt the